This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Durham-born writer John Hart describes himself as a recovering attorney, and his recovery just keeps getting better. A decade ago, he ditched his law practice in Salisbury to pursue his dream of writing a novel. That book, The King of Lies, became a New York Times bestseller, as did his next two novels, and his latest, Iron House, looks like it might outperform them all. John is the only author ever to win the Best Novel Edgar Award for consecutive novels. He also won the Barry Award and England's Steel Dagger Award for Best Thriller of the Year. Iron House, like his other books, is largely set in the countryside of North Carolina, and that landscape is its own character in John Hart's fiction. Beautiful, dangerous, impoverished, and wealthy, all quickly disappearing into the great maw of suburban sprawl. Two brothers raised in a brutal orphanage in the North Carolina mountains are separated by an act of violence, and two decades later, well, I won't spoil it for you. John Hart is in the studio again. Welcome back to the State of Things. So good to have you, John.
Thank you, Frank. It's always one of my favorite stops on the tour.
Love to have you. Let's talk about Iron House. I understand creatively it did grow out of the last novel.
It did. For those that have read The Last Child, they'll remember that it's about a remarkable young boy named Johnny Merriman who, at age 13, lost everything that he had loved his entire life and had sort of learned to lose faith as well in those things he had been taught to trust, the family, the church, the police, his community. This boy was utterly alone. But by the end of that novel, I contrived to give him a relatively soft landing after putting him through his paces, of course. I became intrigued with the idea of what would happen to a boy like that, a clear-eyed, selfless, courageous young kid who never got the soft landing. And I asked myself, what sort of man would he become 20 years down the road if he never had that out?
Soft landing and soft launch in a lot of ways. I mean, your books seem to, now that we have enough to create an arc, the theme emerges that this difference between the haves and have-nots and the foundation on which, from which you start has a lot to do with that. A lot of it has to do with what we might call luck.
Oh, absolutely. And I made a decision early on to try to make my books all about believable characters. Even in Iron House, which is a much more hard-charging thriller, I worked very hard to keep the people very real. And that, for me, is all about motivation. It's about what made the people years ago. I mean, it's about childhood and their upbringing and their community. And so you have to dig into the fabric of that community to make those characters even more credible.
Is that what you did? Because you talked about it in The Last Child, again, the soft landing, things turn out okay. And then you think, well, that same person with a different beginning, a different set of circumstances, things could turn out very differently. Were you able to stick with it? Was that simply an idea and you launched from that, or were you really sort of getting to the life of that individual through this new beginning or different beginning?
Well, you know, I'll clarify one thing. I don't believe in the Hallmark ending for my books. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always a glimmer of hope, a reason to believe that these people have found the strength mm-hmm. to lead happy lives at the end, but it's never easy and it's never clear cut. And that was no different with Iron House. What I did was really up the stakes. I put these two boys in terrible circumstances at an early age. They were found abandoned in a half-frozen creek bed as infants and brought to a Dickensian orphanage up in the North Carolina mountains. And let me tell you, that was fun to write. I mean, that is just fun stuff. And then basically I put this question forward. If one brother is weak and tormented and the other is his protector, and then they're separated at the ages of 10 and 9, down what different paths will they go? You know, will the strong one remain true to his good, strong inner core, or will he become, I hate to use the term corrupted because that's not really it, but will he be shaped by the events of that childhood as he grows up on the streets of New York? And then with the damaged brother, he goes home with a very wealthy family, a North Carolina senator from Chatham County. And, has a very different kind of childhood. And so when both of their lives implode 20 years later and they're finally reunited, what strengths and skill sets do they bring to solving the problem? And, you know, Michael, who ended up in New York, has a very dangerous skill set. And his brother is still the exact opposite, but complex in its own ways.
And so, and of course, the communities they get involved in become a very important part in their lives, as they do for all of us. So we've got the mob and we've got senators, and sometimes politics and the mob business are pretty much indistinguishable.
Yeah, and that thread gets twisted pretty tightly throughout the course of the book, and that was a lot of fun.
Was it something do you research something like that? Do you look for cases, case studies? Certainly you're an attorney. You'd know how to do that.
I get that question a lot, Frank. And my personal bent is to not write the kinds of books that require a lot of research, simply because research feels like work to me. And I'm all about story, and that flows from imagination more than anything else. And so I do the bare bones of research so that I know I'm not going to embarrass myself, but then I really try to make the story about the characters and their internal landscapes, and less about how many bullets does that gun hold. I mean, you read my books, for instance, and I'm picking guns because they're easy, and a lot of thriller writers like these, you know, very specific descriptions. Mine is never going to be, you know, a certain kind of weapon with all these technical details. It's going to be small and shiny, or it's going to have a shine on the trigger and rust on the hammer. I mean, it gets the job done. And so that's the way I tend to approach all the books.
There are a lot of plot twists and a lot of storylines that you have to keep track of. Are these things that you add along the way, or are you paring them back? Give us an insight into the creative process.
I think I'm different from a lot of writers in that I don't outline. And I know that a lot of people will spend months and create very complex structures from which to work. I write in the Grope and Hope school of novel writing, which means I sit down every day and I write in a linear fashion, not knowing exactly what's going to happen, but keeping my mind very open to possibilities. So when I start a novel, you put X number of characters into play, and I give each and every one of them some dark corner of their psyche, some shaded past, something that makes them a reasonable question mark in the reader's mind. And then I do indeed plant big questions, and that depends on what the book is, but something that pulls the reader into the story as they get to know these characters. And the idea is that I live with the characters month over month, and I define their complexities, and I start to think who might have the most credible reason for doing whatever the bad thing is. And because all of these people are capable of something, it gives me a lot of freedom to expand the plot, to make it as complex as I can. And as I live with it month over month, I start to thread it all together and twist the strands. And what the net result was in Iron House is what is far and away my most complex plot. I think there was a great review in the Charlotte paper, also ran in the Raleigh paper, and they called it John Hart 2.0. You know, everything a little bit a little bit faster and a little bit more violent, maybe.
Do you feel that you have to, with all of these plot twists, as you say, tightly threaded together, keep real strict control over your characters? Are you afraid? I mean, not afraid to be, but would it be devastating for you if one of them surprised you and said, I can't commit that crime?
You're asking great questions. It's a thin line you have to walk between the two extremes, because on the one hand, since I write organically and make it up as I go, it's important to give the characters enough rope to really become interesting, because I don't see them full-fleshed when I start the novel. And if you rein in too soon, they're going to be very stiff and unconvincing and maybe not very interesting. I mean, a basic tenet for me of good fiction is that unpredictable characters make for great stories. And so I do like to give them some rein. Eventually, though, near the end of the book, I really do have to make sure that I have firm control so that they are doing what I want. And people ask all the time about this idea of characters taking over and writing their own story. And it sounds like mumbo jumbo to people that don't write, I'm sure. But I think it's very simple. I think that if you live with a character for, let's say, 200 pages and you build them very meticulously, at some point, if you want them to move in one direction, but it doesn't line up with all of the decisions that you've made for them, all of the things that they've said and done, that character will resist. Mm. And that's really a part of the writer's subconscious saying that doesn't fit.
Do you ever find yourself, or have you in this case, having to reject whole plot lines? Were there other complexities in here, other twists that you said, ended up at a dead end?
Yeah, that does happen. And it's simply because while you want to find a richness so that when the reader puts the book down, they marvel that it all tied together somehow. And I think that's one of the great things about this book is that everything does fit at the end. You don't want to overreach, because if you try to do too much, and then it just turns up to be a jumbled mess and people get frustrated. My core belief is that the first gift I have is a writer's faith, that I will not abuse their trust. And as soon as I abuse it once, and in even a single small manner, it's a hard thing to get back. So you do have to be very careful.
Did you have a moment? I mean, are there moments like that in the book where you've got this nice little, it would work, I can get by with this, and then you got to sit down and say, John, that comes out.
Yes. And that's a hard thing. I mean, the old quote, and I guess it was Faulkner, say you have to be willing to kill your darlings. And that's true whether you're talking about a turn of phrase or a plot line or even a character. And so you have to be a hard-eyed, ruthless dictator when it really comes down to it.
Now, you're, of course, landscape, the place, and the place is most often North Carolina, plays an important part in your books. As we said, it becomes a character. It did in your life, and in fact, you have not long ago left North Carolina for the wilds of Charlottesville, somewhere north of here. But for a farm, tell us about that, because you grew up on a farm, and that has played an important part in your life, and it sounds like it still is.
Absolutely. And it's, I get a lot of compliments about my writing, and I get, of course, some zingers too. But one of the compliments that I most enjoy is when a reviewer or a reader or a fan says that character feels, or rather that the setting feels like another character. And I think that's a deep, meaningful statement. And what it simply says is that they can feel and taste and touch the land that I build around my characters. And that comes from knowing a place really well, from loving it and knowing the things that you dislike too. And so I try to be very enmeshed in the surroundings when I write, and because I am a North Carolina kid, that's just, I mean, all my books will probably always be in North Carolina. In fact, the parts of Iron House take place in New York City, and that was very difficult for me to write. In terms of my love of the land, when I was a boy, we had about 500 acres on High Rock Lake. We had 2.5 miles of waterfront. It was a beautiful piece of land that whose borders had not changed since a land grant from the king in the 1600s. Not to my family, but the parcel had never changed. And when my parents divorced, the land was the first victim, I guess after the children, in that it was sold and developed in the worst possible way. And by that, I mean it's a junkyard and it's a trailer park with dogs on chains and plywood additions. I mean, it's really bad. And it'll never, ever be what it was. And I was 10 years old when I lost that, and it's not a coincidence that a lot of pivotal things for the children in my books happen around age 10 to 13. That was certainly important in The Last Child and in Iron House. I have recently moved to this farm in Charlottesville simply because I want to raise my children with the thing that I lost and missed the most, which is that sense of ownership of a beautiful piece of land. And one of the things that's not been talked about in any of my previous interviews that I find especially compelling about the story is that the property that we bought, we actually bought from a developer. It was slated for development. And so we not only have this for my children and hopefully my grandchildren, but we've also kept it from being developed. And so it feels like a really nice 180.
So we shouldn't be surprised that your characters, that the land does play such an important part. It's been a clear part of your identity growing up, not only losing your family over this, but the land as well. And this business of foundation, we get back to the original premise that we, depending on your circumstances, you may turn out. Character, genetics have something to do with it, but that foundation is important, and the land is so important. What I find amazing about your books is you can get into these kind of deep spiritual questions about our identification with things as like the land or what happened to us when we were 10. But this thing, it moves, it pops. I mean, people die, heads roll. It's a thriller through and through. And all of these very deep ideas are in there, embedded quite beautifully. And you can find them if you want or not.
Right. Well, it's if there's a reason that my career has worked, it's because I believe I've found a way to do those two things together. And I give my wife a lot of credit for that. I grew up reading fast-paced novels. I like an accelerant that pulls me through the pages. My wife likes Oprah books. And by that, I mean simply she wants that meaningful interrelationship between the characters, the backstory, all of that subtext that I never really much cared about as a young reader. And so I decided early on I was going to try to write a book that would satisfy us both and that she would respect. And it's important, I think, for your spouse to respect what you do. And the first two failed novels I wrote, and I did have two, she described as comic booky. And, you know, and she married me in spite of having read these these things.
But she wanted to reform you.
She did. And, you know, I like to try to explain what comic booky books mean. And I preface this by saying I enjoy reading some comic booky stuff. But if a book has between its jackets either a hovercraft, a ninja, or an antimatter bomb, you know, it's probably a comic booky book. And my wife isn't going to have that from me.
When you write these books now, and I guess what I'm getting at too is it revealing to you? You set out to write adventures, thrillers, it works, but all the while that you're sort of probing these other things, do you find things out about yourself, particularly with Iron House, as we said, much more complex? Did it take you inside yourself in a way you hadn't expected?
The old joke is that writing fiction is cheap therapy. Mm-hmm. And sure, I mean, there's always a line in fiction that weaves throughout the story. And on one side is the author and hints of the author, and on the other is pure imagination. And I would be hard-pressed to identify the exact line. What I can say for fact is that the way I write characters is to try to build myself into that skin, and that's all about what experiences I've had, what memories, emotions, whatever, and then taking that basis and trying to extrapolate. I mean, for instance, I can remember what it felt like when my family broke up and I was 10 and everything that I thought I had, I suddenly didn't. It was a garden variety divorce. It wasn't particularly traumatic, but I can take that experience and magnify it 100 times to find the boys that I needed for Iron House. And so, and there are a million instances in a novel where you see that sort of thing coming from the author. In terms of exploring thematic elements, I do think it's important. That's never my primary goal. I'm a storyteller first and foremost, but if I can get a good, you know, thoughtful response, I'm happy.
You know, sometimes, though, less interesting to me to find out what of the author went into the book than what the author discovered about themselves after the book was finished. And I just wondered if any of that had happened to you.
Man, I don't know that there's a short, clean answer to that. I mean, it's this whole thing.
I'll get your wife on.
Let's see. Yeah, this whole thing is a journey, Frank. And I mean, I'm finding out things about myself even now. I'm 45 years old, and I'm still learning things about myself. Makes me think of my stepfather, who said when he was 80, "I can't wait to see what I'd be when I grow up." And so, and sometimes I feel like that.
You studied French existentials, the existentialist and French writers when you were in college.
I did.
Does this stuff inform your work?
Absolutely. In fact, it's probably an underappreciated aspect of what I do, because what I took from studying French existentialism is that it's about relatively normal people getting to a place in their life where nothing makes sense anymore, and they have to look at their choices and where they are and the things they've done and decide if they're not happy about it, how do they get there and what are they going to do to go forward in a different direction. And that's at the core of everything I've written. Every single protagonist in any of my books has had that existential moment, and usually that's the beginning of the book. How did I get here? This is really not a good place, and what do I do to get out?
And it was a great exploration in that time in our history to sort of focus on the individual and the way we do construct our lives, construct meaning for ourselves. And now, are we at a point where we can start putting Humpty back together again now that we've figured out that, you know, it's not all determined, that we do a lot of making it up as we go along? And communities, too. There's a communal identity that we should be concentrating on that also plays a bigger part.
Oh, man. I definitely believe that we need to be concentrating more on a communal identity, because I think that's what we're losing right now. And I read a great article the other day talking about how 50 years ago, if we were bad parents, we could count on the culture to raise our children so they weren't axe murderers and such. And I fear that we're losing that. I mean, we're a transient society now. People move all the time. Witness my own move recently. I think it's important that we hang on to that sense of community and do look out for each other. And I think we're losing it. I really do.
Well, I want to thank you. And I know we haven't lost you forever. You're just up the road. And we know that you'll be back with your next book, no doubt.
Oh, absolutely, Frank. Thank you.
John, always a pleasure. John Hart's new novel is Iron House, just out on St. Martin's Press. Coming up on The State of Things, Dex Romweber has influenced a generation of young rockers. He and his sister Sarah are the Dex Romweber duo, and they are next on The State of Things. Stay tuned.